This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. You know, we may not run radio ads on WMRA, but we do recognize their existence. And I, personally, find the whole psychology of advertising extremely interesting, which is just one of the things I'll shortly be talking about with sound producer, writer, and Beatles fanatic Mike Holmes. But first, as the American history guys say, let's delve into the backstory, not only of Mr. Holmes, but of WMRA. Mike Holmes first came to Harrisonburg in 1968 to go to college.
When I came here as a freshman from Springfield in 1968, I met this guy. His name was John Stanley. And just out of the blue one day, I wasn't even into doing voices at the time, like I do now. I just let go with some AM radio type sentence, you know? I don't even remember what it was. And he looked at me and says, have you ever done radio before?
Do an example of AM radio sentence.
Oh, my God. This is embarrassing. I don't know if I can do it. I said something.
Come on.
I attribute this to a guy who was very famous in the Washington area. His name was Jack Alex. And everybody, when I was in high school, knew who he was. And generally, they held him in contempt because they thought he was a phony. But everybody listened to him. Okay.
Yes.
And his signature line was, here we go with the great sound around our town. And then the call letters of the station, which was, I think, WEAM. They called themselves the Weem Redcoat Gang because they wore red coats when they emceed dances and stuff. So it was something like this. Here we go with the great sound around our town. You know, it was like that. And that's something. I think that's what I did to him, said to him. And he says, have you ever done radio before? And I said, uh-uh. What's that? And he said, well, I'm program director of the new campus radio station.
WXJM.
Said, no, it was WMCL, which
I
is this one. And it was stood for Madison College. But they put in the application for it. But somebody else had the application for those letters in before we did. And so they got it. We had to change. We had to find something else. So we came up with WMRA for Madison Radio. And it was where the president's office is now. And, well, at that time, he said, do you want to come up and see everything? And I said, well, yeah, I've never been in a radio studio before. Well, I went up there, and the equipment was still in the boxes.
It was brand new.
Oh, it was absolutely new. I'd never seen a console or nothing. And so they got set up, and somehow or the other, he taught me how to use it and gave me an air shift. But at that time, they were giving anybody that walked in the door an air shift. And at one time, there was 50 people who had air shifts on this station. And they could do whatever they darn wanted.
What'd you do?
Played rock and roll.
Of course.
They had a good-sized library, and I had a good-sized one myself, and I played all my own records and theirs and all these LPs on these huge old Gates tables, you know. Oh, they were wonderful. I think that the hero of that station, if you want to know, was Charles Rothgib, who goes by Charles Graves, which I think is his middle name, who was on WSVA. And his life's ambition was to work on WSVA. And he did the news at WMRA, only he did a half hour every night. Now, he's a student. And he called this thing Information Central. And he had stringers all over the campus. It was about nothing but campus news. And he managed to cobble a half an hour every night. And he had theme music and everything. And he had all these actualities from kids. And I don't know where he got time to study. And he had a pirate radio station in the dorm, which he called Radio Free Ashby. And it got to a few dorms is what it did. It was like a 1-watt transmitter. It was about this big. But MRA had a 10-watt transmitter. That's all we had. And it was an antenna behind Anthony Seeger School that was 15 feet in the air.
And that was it.
Yeah. And it got to the up campus. Okay. And all those buildings on either side of the quad were all dorms. But when you got down to the D hall, no more WMRA because it's a hill. And that FM energy was on this tiny little tower, and it hit Wilson Hall, and it wouldn't go past it. So nobody down the hill could get it. How terrible.
Here you go. You've never been in a radio station. Now you're jocking rock and roll, and you're still working in this. What was the attraction?
You know how you find out that you can do something?
Yeah.
And you never had an idea that you could? Well, I started producing funny stuff. I just found out I could produce things, first off. I could put together music, sound effects, vocal, and I could write. I just discovered this by doing it. And the equipment we had was primitive. I mean, there was no multi-track then, you know. I mean, the Beatles had four tracks, you know. Now you can have 200 if you want. But we did it all on cart machines, just bouncing it back and forth. And if you wanted a lot of stuff, you ended up going down a lot of generations in the first couple of intros. Oh, my God, you know. And so it was wonderful. And I ended up calling myself Captain Ugly.
No kidding.
Yeah, and there was a guy named Dave Grimes who is the Commonwealth's attorney for Pennsylvania County. He's been that way forever. And he did some drops for me, you know, introducing the show. And now more music from Captain Ugly. Like that with a little bit of music. And another guy, Chris Buxton, came up with, it's Captain Ugly weather time! And there was ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba in the background. Dumb stuff like that. You know, we had no idea what we were doing.
This is Rock and Roll Radio. Come on, let's rock and roll.
Rock and Roll Radio. Let's go. Rock and Roll Radio. Let's go.
This is Rock and Roll Radio. Stay tuned for more rock and roll.
Mike Holmes graduated from JMU and went to work behind a camera for Harrisonburg's public television station. Then radio lured him back, and after a while, Mike began writing and producing ads.
I got so lucky. A friend of mine from Broadway moved to Washington to become a graphic designer, and he went to work for a guy named Berkey Belser, who's a big-time designer in Washington. And they were employing a freelance writer who had worked for Dancer, Fitzgerald Sample in New York, the agency that did Toyota's Oh, What a Feeling. They wrote Peter Paul's Sometimes You Feel Like a Nut, Sometimes You Don't, which is considered the ninth best commercial jingle ever written. And he had quit over a fight with somebody else as to who was going to get Frigidaire's national account. And so he just started freelancing, and Berkey hired him to write freelance. Well, my buddy from Broadway who was up there went to this guy, and he said, I have a friend in Harrisonburg that does commercials. Could you critique his stuff? And this guy says, sure. And so I sent him a commercial. I sent him a cassette.
People are nice, aren't they?
Well, they are.
Yeah.
And I sent him a cassette, had 10 commercials on it. Well, this is before the internet, and it was before faxing. It was 1981. And he wrote me back a 5-page single-space typewritten letter. Now, how many words is that? That's a couple thousand at least.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he ripped every one of those 10 commercials into tiny little pieces of confetti. And he said, you have wonderful production skills. He said, but you don't know anything at all about advertising. He said, but because you're good at doing this, if you learned the principles of advertising, you could really do something.
So, now, but because you were good, that meant you wrote well and you had good production skills. Mm-hmm. You just didn't know what to say.
No. Okay. I didn't know. Oh, I could go on forever about what I didn't know and what I still don't know, because the more you learn, the more you realize you don't mm-hmm. know. And so he said, I will teach you advertising. And I said, for how much money? And he says, for nothing.
What?
And I said, really? And he goes, sure. And so he told me some stuff in letters, and then I started writing things, and I was making carbon copies on the typewriter. And I'd mail him the carbons, and he'd mark them up like he's my teacher, right, and send them back to me. And he would say, this is reword this, you know, people don't really think this, you know, people don't do this. But after a while, I started getting them back, yes, in huge letters, you know.
Good.
Really, yeah. And then he wrote, you learn fast. And I'm going, wow, am I awake, you know? And
what do you think changed in what you were writing? I mean, just can you give us a sense of going from where you started to where you went?
What changed was I learned how people respond to what they hear, especially when it's something intrusive like a commercial. Because let's face it, people hate commercials. Mm-hmm. Now, we talk about them. But generally when we talk about them, and here's where the great mistake in writing commercials is. We talk about them and we laugh about them, and then one person will invariably say, who was it for? And the other person will go, oh, I can't remember. That's a failure. Somebody paid a lot of money to entertain the public, but not to get them to cross their threshold. Well, I was real good at doing that. I could make people laugh. See, and I'll give you a good example of one. I did a series of vignettes in this one ad of famous people saying things that we know that they've said only their feet were hurting them, and they would in the middle of what they were saying, they would go, ouch, you know, because their feeding were. So I sent that off to Chuck, my mentor.
And what were you advertising?
It was Charles Smith Shoes in Valley Mall.
Okay.
And so he said, he wrote back to me and he says, Mike, people don't buy shoes because their feet are hurting. They buy shoes because the ones they've got are worn out or they're out of style. That's why they buy them. But you know what's going to happen? He says, you're going to play this for Charlie. He's going to laugh because it was funny. And he's going to say, run it. And then his buddies at the Elks are going to come up to him and say, hey, Charlie, I heard your ad on the radio. It was really funny there, buddy. You know, and he's going to think, I'm a success. And then at the end of the year, his accountant's going to say, you didn't make a dime more this year than you did last year, and you paid this guy to write your stuff. You nuts? And I thought, uh-oh. I'm in trouble. I need to learn something.
Which he did. You can hear some of Mike's recent ads by clicking on a link to Mike Holmes Radio that you'll find on the Spark page at WMRA.org. But wait, there's more. After Matt Bingay's invitation to check this out and a short break, we'll be back to talk about other kinds of sound production with Mike Holmes. This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Before the break, I was talking with sound producer, writer, Beatles fanatic Mike Holmes of Harrisonburg about the very early days of WMRA, on which he jocked rock and roll, believe it or not, and through which he discovered the joys of making radio. We also talked about Mike's luck-filled career as a producer of radio ads. Recently, however, Mr. Holmes has developed a new career/passion. Producing and narrating a series of stories he calls The Americans.
16 years ago, unsolicited, I get this newspaper called Old News in my mailbox, and I go, what's this? And I start reading. I'm three paragraphs into the first story, and I go looking for the subscription blank. I thought, I got to have this. I fell in love with it instantly.
Why? What?
Well, because it was stories about people. It's biography of people from history, some you've heard of, some you think you know intimately, and you really don't. And then people you've never heard of, and it's concerns itself with people from antiquity, from around the world, up until about the 1940s. And so I've been subscribing to it for 16 years, and I'm such a snail. Why did it take me 16 years to think, wouldn't it be cool if I did an audio version of a few of these things because I like them? And so I called I found out who the publisher was, and I called him up, and I told him, and he said, well, yeah, I wanted to do one. And so I did this one on Amelia Earhart.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent it to him, and he emails me back, you know, that's more fun to listen to than it is to read. And I went, well, that's cool. And I said, why don't I do a bunch of them and see if I can market them? And he goes, well, that's a good idea. Who do you want to do? And I thought, okay, what's the first thing I should do? Well, I wanted to have as broad an appeal as I can. So I thought, I'm going to do it on names that people are familiar with and then put some in there that they're not familiar with, but they're all from here. Okay. So I decided to do The Americans. And so the people that we know about are Earhart, Francis Scott Key, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Mark Twain, and then there's people that we don't know about. Okay, Elizabeth Blackwell, the first licensed female physician in the United States, and what she had to go through. You know, the medical schools wouldn't touch her. And then I did one on Dorothea Dix. She taught a Bible class in a women's prison, and she heard screaming going on. She asked this jailer, "What's that?" "Oh, it's just a lunatic." And she says, "Well, I want to see the lunatic." And she saw this, they had these two women, they were living in cages, and they were wearing almost nothing, and it was freezing. And she said, why don't you give them any heat? And the jailer says, oh, the lunatics don't feel cold as others do. And I don't know where people get the stupid ideas they get about things. And she decided she was going to reform this situation. Yeah. And she got to where she was so good that the mere mention that she'd gone into a state sent everybody in the entire state scrambling to do something about their insane asylums.
Okay, Mike, I want to stop you there for just a second and take a break from our conversation about the Americans, this series of historical stories that you're producing. And I want to play a 3-minute excerpt from the sound story you've produced on Francis Scott Key. It comes right from the middle of it. It's where the action is sort of hotting up, so to speak. So here we go.
The British officers cheerfully explained to Francis Scott Key exactly how they planned to capture Baltimore. While Marines attacked the city by land, the fleet would sail right up the Patapsco River into Baltimore's inner harbor, where the big guns of the Royal Navy could flatten the business district at point-blank range. The only obstacle standing between the fleet and victory was Fort McHenry, a star-shaped bastion faced with red brick masonry which commanded the approach to Baltimore on the Patapsco River. Although Fort McHenry's ramparts bristled with 57 cannon, Admiral Cochrane felt confident that he could blast the American fortress into submission. Fort McHenry's cannon were old-fashioned weapons firing cannonballs over a maximum range of 2,800 yards. The British fleet was equipped with superior new weapons, rockets and mortars, which could hurl explosive shells over 4,200 yards. The British fleet hove into sight of Fort McHenry on the afternoon of September 11, 1814. As alarm guns boomed ashore, the fleet quietly anchored off North Point, about 8 miles from the American fort. Through his spyglass, Francis Scott Key could see the American flag fluttering above Fort McHenry's ramparts. The flag was huge. The commander of the fort, Major George Armistead, had spent over $400 of the taxpayers' money to acquire one of the most impressive American banners in existence. "It is my desire," Major Armistead had said, "to have a flag so large that the British will have no difficulty seeing it from a distance." His grand standard, sewn by Widow Mary Pickersgill of Baltimore and her 13-year-old daughter Caroline, measured 42 by 30 feet. Temporarily ignoring the fort and its flag, the British fleet began landing thousands of Marines at North Point. They encountered no opposition at the beach. The American militia was digging into defensive positions much closer to Baltimore. It took the British all night to land their large force. The British Marines were finally ready to march at sunrise on September 12th, when they formed ranks behind General Ross and set out for Baltimore. Francis Scott Key watched the British military operation from the deck of the frigate HMS Surprise, now serving as Admiral Cochrane's flagship. Soon after dawn, Key saw British bomb vessels slowly sailing toward Fort McHenry. Key saw an American flag rise above the fort. At this time, Major Armistead may have replaced his 42-foot banner with a less expensive 25-foot storm flag that he kept in reserve for emergency situations. Before the sun grew warm, the British bomb vessels opened fire. Key saw explosions hurling rubble into the air around the base of the flag as the British mortars began lobbing 200-pound bombs into Fort McHenry. The bomb vessels HMS Meteor, Terror, Devastation, and Etna, and the rocket ship Erebus, were able to hit the fort while anchored at a safe distance of 2 miles from its walls. Since the American guns had a range of only a mile and a half, their return fire was harmless. American gun crews were being blown to bits. "We felt like pigeons tied up by the legs to be shot at," an American artilleryman later wrote. Morale in the fort began to sag until a rooster jumped onto the parapet of Fort McHenry to crow in the direction of the British fleet. As bombs crashed around it, the rooster continued to crow until all the men in the fort were laughing and cheering. Somebody yelled, "If I live to see Baltimore again, I'm going to buy that bird a pound cake." From Francis Scott Key's vantage point with the British fleet, he could see that the men in Fort McHenry must be...
Okay, Mike Holmes, that was a taste of the Francis Scott Key segment of your series, The Americans. And I'm so interested in the decisions that you made, being somebody who works with sound, the decisions that you made about how to use sound to build the sense that battle is coming.
Yes.
So talk about
that.
All
right, it's entirely instinctive. And I'm very lucky in that, boy, now you talk about two things coming together at the right time. I cannot tell you how lucky I was. A month after I decided to do these things, I knew that I did not have enough music of the right type to do these things. And I thought, what am I going to do? I had enough to do the Earhart story, but then I was out of them, and I wasn't going to use a track twice. And so I've been looking for production music and sound effects online for 15 years, and I've gone through hundreds of collections, and they all stink just about. Well, I ran into one called Audio Network, which is based in the UK. They recorded Abbey Road Studios, where the Beatles recorded, and the guy that owns the place knows George Martin, their producer. Martha, every genre of music you can possibly think of, they have, and I've never seen another, the breadth of that, not by a long shot, and it's all excellent, okay? And then on top of that, they have a sound effects library that beats everything I have ever seen. Now, a sound effect, if you think about it, is really a sequence of events, really. I'll give you an example. I thought, all right, I'm going to see how good these people really are. I want the sound of a horse galloping toward the microphone, toward me, mm-hmm. on a dirt road, which is going to sound different than cobblestones. Mm-hmm. It's going to sound different than snow. He stops in front of me, and the rider gets off. I can hear him get off, and I can hear the squeak of the saddle leather. There's no such thing as a library that would have a thing like that. These guys do. They've got that very sequence. If the horse is coming toward me, it stops. You hear the guy get off, and you hear the I'm a horseback rider, okay? And I heard the saddle leather creaking, and I went, I don't believe this is happening.
How did you find it? Did you search horse
coming?
Yeah,
they've got this wonderful search engine.
Okay.
You can search all kinds of different ways. And if you still can't find what you want, you can call them or email them and give them this huge description, the longer the better. This is what I want this to do. And they'll research it for you. And then they'll send you 10 possibilities.
Is this site expensive?
Yeah, it's hideously expensive.
So and, I guess I'm not going to be taking this as a tip.
Well, the thing of it is they gave me this incredible deal on it because I told them, I don't want this for commercials. All I want it for is to do audiobooks with. And I don't have a lot of money to do it with. And they said, well, how about $500 for a year?
Wow.
And that's cheap because this is a $4,000 a year library.
Yeah.
And I said, you don't have to do this for me. And they said, it's our pleasure.
People are nice.
Oh, boy, they are.
I'll say it again.
And one day I called them because I was stuck for a track. And I don't want to take too much time with this, but it's really cool. I was talking with a business manager, and he was going to send me to Creative Services. And I said, do you ever talk to any of the clients about how much they like this library? And he said, no. And I said, can I tell you how much I like it? And he goes, sure. And I started telling him, and he stopped me. And he says, the owner of the company is here in the New York office from the UK. He said, he's right here. He said, would you tell him all this stuff? And I said, sure. And his name's Andrew. And he goes, Michael, it's so wonderful to talk with you. He said, I understand you really like what we've got. And I said, yeah. I said, you've saved my life literally with this project that I'm doing. Well, tell me about it. So I told him. And he said, well, I've got to go. And he said, it's lovely talking with you, but I've got people that want me. And I said, well, could you send me to Creative Services? And he says, oh, first I said, I understand you recorded Abbey Road with a Philharmonic. And he goes, yeah. And I said, do you know George Martin? Because I'm a Beatles fanatic. And he said, yeah, he's a friend of mine. I about collapsed. And I thought, I'm one person away from George Martin.
Yes.
And he says, the other day we cut a track on the piano that the Beatles used to record Lady Madonna on. Well, I about dropped the phone. You know, I thought, I can't believe this is happening. And he says, well, I've got to go. And I said, well, could you send me to Creative Services? And he said, well, are you looking for a track? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, tell me about it. And I said, well, you know that the track called such and such, which I've already used. I said, I need a track that does what it does, only I won't use one twice. And he says, well, I'll tell you what. He says, even though I got people who want to talk to me, he says, I'm going to ring off and I'm going to look it up for you and I'll call you back. And I said, Andrew, please, you don't have to do this, you know. And he says, no. He says, I need to keep my hand in. And I went, okay. And so he hang up and I'm sitting in my chair in my office thinking, okay, I just got off the phone with a guy that has this incredible music library that records at Abbey Road Studios, who knows the Beatles producer,
and
has used them to touch this piano. And right at this particular moment, he is looking for a piece of music from me.
You know you should be glad.